Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 148, featuring Lars Lerup. Lon, you were in Houston with me, right, during that time?
Yeah, it was exciting to walk through the hallowed halls of Rice University Architecture School.
Yeah.
And doesn't look like architecture schools changed that much. You got white walls, a lot of projects up on the wall.
Yeah, and juries were going on, which was kind of like both exciting to see and stressful because of remembering the old times when you had to present your project.
I just like how you walked in and you saw one of your old professors after 20 years and went up and you guys just started chatting like, oh, yeah, I remember.
Yeah.
Like it was, you know, last Tuesday, that was the last time you guys saw each other.
Well, Rice is kind of a unique school. I mean, obviously, like you said, I graduated 20 years ago, so that was kind of exciting. But it was also a really small school, right? So to get people in perspective, in my class, there are only 14 people accepted in that class.
So yeah, it was, you know, it's always been super exclusive. It's top 10 for graduate and undergraduate.
Yeah. It's very, very much up there. And it was interesting because 20 years ago was also like the first year that Lars started as the dean of the architecture school. And that's when I started as a student there. And he's a very controversial person. He likes to say controversial things, and you'll notice it when he says it on the podcast, just because it gets you excited about things and gets you thinking and pushes you to look into different things. And I always appreciated it. And that's why I picked him as my thesis advisor. And he was really cool. It was really great to talk to him. He is now emeritus. He's no longer the dean. He's retiring soon. So I was really glad to be able to catch him while I was there. It was really fun being back at the school after 20 years. And so there are two big people that I spoke to while I was there. One was Lars, who is my thesis advisor, and the other one was Shisha. And we'll talk about her when her podcast will be coming up. And she's the one who taught me computer graphics way back then. It was really exciting to do that. So hopefully you guys will enjoy what Lars has to say. But you have a couple of announcements, Alam. You're going to AU. I think by the time this podcast comes out, you will be in Vegas.
We'll be in Vegas. Yeah. We'll be at Autodesk University again. And looking forward to that. We've got a big booth there, and hopefully people will come by and say hi. And
if they come, if they come see you, then maybe you can show them some cool stuff.
We'll step into VR. We'll talk about, you know,
some 6 degrees of freedom action.
All of the degrees. We have every degree of freedom.
Every degree. 6, 7, 8, 12 degrees of freedom. Go through different dimensions. It's really cool. If you haven't seen some of the VR stuff that we've been sort of showcasing here and there, and if you haven't seen it, definitely check it out. It's something to experience. A couple other things that I want to ask people to do is to make sure to rate our podcast and check it out. I've been asked to make sure that people know this. So if you guys are listening to us on iTunes, make sure and give us a rating and give us a review there.
5 stars.
5 stars would be great.
If it's stars
that
we need.
And the same thing on Facebook. We've actually, I think Sean has just put up a rating system on Facebook. So if you go to facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast, all one word, you'll be able to give us a rating and write us a review. I really want to hear what you guys think, and we could really use some feedback. See if things you want to hear, what types of conversations you have, things you like, things you like to hear more of. It would be great to find out about that.
Can I tell you my favorite part of visiting Rice University?
Sure.
With you and your tour? There's actually two.
There's two parts.
There's two. Okay. One is the frog wall.
The frog wall, yes.
Which I'll try to do my best to describe it, but around the opening of one of the doorways is a marble frame around one of the doors, and it has these series of dots that are kind embedded.
Kind of like a braille.
And if you lick your finger and you run your finger down the series of dots, it sounds like a frog croaking.
That's right.
Which is a good little magic trick.
Yeah. Rice has got a lot of those weird little things all over the place.
And then we also went to the local establishment called Valhalla, which
across the street from the architecture school.
Which every architecture school needs to have a like underground bar for, you know, those moments after you go through your critique or whatever. And so we went into this basement bar which was awesome. Yep. And the mascot on the wall for Valhalla was an owl, which is Rice's mascot,
right,
wearing a Viking helmet. And I've never wanted a tattoo in my life, but somehow I feel like that might be, you know, that might be it.
Yeah, it's cool. Valhalla was a graduate student bar that was also nonprofit. And when I went to school 20 years ago, a beer cost 50 cents. I think now it's a few bucks.
Yep.
But yeah, it's really cool to see that. All right, guys. Hopefully you will enjoy this awesome podcast with Lars, one of my big mentors and a big influence in my life. So it's very personal to me, and hopefully you guys will be able to enjoy it as well. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
That was a long time ago.
When you were doing a part. Yeah.
That was my, you know.
So what were you doing at Xerox Park?
So John Seely Brown, who ran Xerox Park at that time,
yeah,
he had this idea that they had three offices. They had one office in Switzerland and one office in Seattle and, of course, the one in Xerox Park. And they always had these time lapses, particularly with lapses with Europe. So they wanted to have a kind of, they set up exactly the same space in all three places.
Right.
And they, and you had that on the screen. So you'd see people in Switzerland walking by in the same space you were in.
Right.
And this was a way of cutting down on trips so that they could operate together in this space.
Okay.
And there were a bunch of really interesting people involved in this. And so we were supposed to design the office. That was another sort of byproduct of John Seely Brown. And so this was the test. So they set up three designers in Xerox Park in different rooms you'd never met before.
Right.
And we had a screen, and we were going to design this office together.
Uh-huh.
As if it were the three offices working together.
Okay.
So we were there for a couple of days, and there was one guy who then retired, I think, up in Maine, who refused to use the keyboard at that time. So he had the keyboard behind the computer, and they were always mucking with screwdrivers and things. You know, it was like really the beginning,
right,
and lots of cables. And that's when I made a discovery. I put tracing paper on the computer and drew.
Uh-huh.
So there were. It was really fun. We made a book on it, and they made a book on it, and I don't know if I have a copy of it, but it was a very exciting time for all kinds of reasons. And then, I spent a lot of time around Xerox Park, and I realized there were people who were working on the Indian stuff and the Kabbalah. And
what year was this about?
Must have been in the 80s.
In the 80s?
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah, I was in Berkeley, of course.
Can you get a little closer if that's okay?
Yeah, I was at Berkeley, so it must have been in the 80s, but it was relatively early in the 80s, I think. You know, I started at Berkeley, found an Indian kid that know how to do rendering. I was one of the first on my faculty that started to use rendering.
Really?
So I have had, you know, very close to relationship to computing, but never really been anything but the sort of instigator. I never knew who it worked, but I always had these drivers, yeah, you know, which is, it's a kind of strange relationship. And I realized that, and of course, that's because in graduate school, I was at MIT most of the time because we had a revolution at Harvard. And I spent all my time around Nicholas Negroponte and people like Marvin Minsky, who I adored. He was a fantastic guy. And, you know, I was an innocent bystander. I was never really involved. I was more like looking in over the fence.
Right, right, right.
So I was very comfortable with computing because I, you know, I'd been through batch processing and all that stuff. And so it was familiar to me somehow.
Right.
And therefore, I never had these fears. And when I came here to Rice, a guy named Gori, who ran their computing at that, we were the only ones that were pushing to have computing at Rice.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I remember humanities dean and said, why do you need this? This is ridiculous. You know, why?
Well, when I came here, this was so I came here in 93.
Exactly.
And
it was exactly the same year.
Right. So you had started in 92, I believe.
I started actually in the summer of 93, yeah. So
okay.
We came at the same time.
So I was the first class, and you
right.
were of your deanship, should
right.
I say.
Exactly.
And you, Michael Bell and David Guthrie, right?
Exactly.
That was the first studio. And
yeah.
I guess, and Ravel was brand new.
Ravel was brand new, yes.
Brand new. And there was the SGIs were there for the first time
right.
and
yeah.
work. And I just like, I just
yeah.
sucked it in. And
yeah.
Shisha was here. By the way, Shisha is going to do my second podcast.
Oh, and
we're
going to
talk about like the old computing stuff as
yeah.
well. But you were very encouraging of
yeah.
that stuff. It was more like, hey, you try it. Tell me what you can come out of this stuff, you know?
And well, I there's something that I learned about Texas, which was different than other places, and maybe one of the most charming things about Texas is, let us try it.
Right.
I think that's a kind of, maybe it's it goes back to the old oil days,
uh-huh.
you know, when these guys... went to the oil companies that had leased all the land and said, can we dig on this piece or drill on this piece?
Right,
and
right.
we pay you $50,000 if you find oil. We'll get rich, and if we don't, that's our problem.
Right.
And those guys, they were always, you know, you operated in a completely sort of unknown world because you didn't know if you were going to get a gush or not.
Right.
So it required a certain kind of both chutzpah and a willingness to try things.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that it has prevailed, but there is some sense of it still in Texas.
So that, there's less risk aversion, you think?
Yeah. More willing to lose 50,000, you know.
Right.
And then there are in other places, you know. So the codes are different here.
Uh-huh.
In other places, they are much more stringent, and you can't do this, you can't do that. And
right.
Like in France, for saying, you know, they say, oh, ça, on peut pas faire. That we can't
yeah.
do. It's impossible. You know, I've encountered that so many times when I lived in Paris. But, Texas is different that way. And that I think I kind of it sort of fits my personality because I mean one of the biggest problem I see is that imagination is so hard to foster and it's been so constrained, and I just see it in the new group of students. They are really risk averse. I mean, they're not willing to take any of these risks. And that means that the imagination never flourishes. It just is sat upon.
Mm.
When I think it ought to be the time when we really should use imagination, because we have now a completely different problem. You know, a student of mine asked me yesterday, "What you talk about planetary urbanism? What do you mean by that?" And I said, "Well, you know, I started out with a house. That was my universe." Then it became the city. Well, that was a much more complicated universe. And now it's the planet,
mm-hmm.
the whole damn thing. And when you do a house again in that planetary thing, you realize it affects the whole thing. I mean, if you decide to do wood windows instead of aluminum windows.
Right.
If you decide to build everything in wood rather than concrete. In other words, the whole material issue has become much, much greater. And you know, so there are things like scale difference. So, you read about the Three Gorges Dam. The Three Gorges Dam, they speculate, changed the rotation of the Earth because of the weight. And you say, well, how about Manhattan? How about San Francisco? San Francisco sits on this plate. What happens when it presses on that plate? Does that promote earthquakes? In other words, right. we get back to the Anthropocene. We create a new geology, and that's our new geology.
Right, right, right.
And that's what we have to contend with now.
Right.
So every decision you make has become immensely complex. So how do you cut through that? You know, I studied with a meteorologist, a colleague, a German guy named Horst Rittel, and he said, if you can define the problem space, you know, he was making one of those X and Y axes, and right. he said, if you can constrain the, you will have much better results. In other words, there will be more innovation the more constraints you are. So you have to sort out among these planetary constraints.
I've always said that, and I think that constraints is what allows for creativity.
Yeah, exactly. But look at what's happening in Puerto Rico that I happen to be very familiar with since my wife is Puerto Rican.
Right.
Since it is the last colony, maybe not the last, who knows, Mars right. might be the next one, and it's basically abandoned by Trump and his gang. The innovation that you see that was not really in the hands of the Puerto Ricans before, they were, because they were sucking off the teat of the U.S., you know. Mm-hmm. Everything came in with three shipping lines that had, that in the Jones Act, that owned, had all the prices fixed, of course. Everything was three times as expensive as Houston, for example. Mm-hmm. But now, there's nothing there. So what would I do? Well, they do all kinds of new innovations. They, you know, they stick pipes into mountains to get water out.
Right.
There is a kind of new spirit in a way, at the same time as it's horrible.
Right. You know?
So all of this, it seems to me that we are in some way, particularly in architecture, it's become so enclosed, and because of this obsession with formalism. I mean, it's so interesting to see a guy like you that have entered into to the representational world and have so much more fun. There's so much more innovation there.
I'm so glad you brought this up, because this is actually a subject I want to talk about, very specifically a problem that I think exists. And keep in mind that a lot of the audience, I have a very diverse audience for this podcast. So there's architects, there's visual effects artists, there's automotive people, entertainers, directors, etc. But specifically, I went to a conference in Portugal, which is an amazing conference. It's called Trojan Horse Was a Unicorn. It is all about creativity. It's incredibly inspiring. The thing that's interesting about it is that it's most of the people who go there and the speakers are all concept artists for the big movies, etc. A lot of concept artists. That's one of the main things that they go there. I had proposed to bring the subject of architecture as another creative thing that's important to talk about when you're thinking about concept art or whatever. When people came there, I remember a very specific conversation that I had with someone. She said, oh, I saw that you were going to give a talk about architecture. I used to be an architect, just like me, right? But I quit because architecture is so boring. So that's my question. Why is architecture boring? Because part of me can't refute that. I agree that it's exciting if you look for the exciting things, but it's really hard for people to be inspired by architecture. And I think that my theory behind it is story. You always told a story with everything you did. Everything was about a narrative that brought to light a subject in some way or form. And yet your stories are not linear too, which I also like. They kind of go all over the place and reconnect. But what do we think has happened in the world of architecture that could be more exciting over the last 20 years or so?
Well, you know, architecture has lots of constraints. First, you can hurt yourself in architecture. Secondly, it costs a lot of money.
Right.
Well, of course, making movies costs a lot of money too.
Sure.
There is a risk level of risk taking. The problem is that it's the environment is coded in such a stringent way. In other words, if I ask a student advice in architecture, design me a house, design me a house plan, it'll be exactly the same house plan that everybody. It's the three-car garage, because if you don't have a garage, you can't get a mortgage. It is the dining, kitchen, living room, now tied together because you can save on cutting down the walls. And then there's the master bedroom, and you know, I mean, it's the same because nobody ever thinks about how do you actually manifest or how do you assist in any creative, interesting life.
Right.
I work in my living room because that is my life.
Right. Right.
So in other words, the real problem is that we have all these patterns set instead of realizing that the program itself is where the real creativity lies.
The program.
The program is that story.
Right.
It is that fiction. It is that potential. You know, for example, if you look at the Palladian villa, it's very unclear how they lived in it. You know that they cooked in the basement. But with this enfilade of rooms, it's just like, you know, a dog trot. Mm-hmm. You have to go through all the rooms. There's no privacy.
Right. There's no corridor.
We invented the corridor in order to have privacy. So, you know, kids could do their thing by themselves. And parents could do their thing by themselves. And, you know, I dabbled in this in my first project, and I did the fresh window where the kids could look at the parents in the bedroom. I made stairs that led nowhere and things like that.
Yeah.
Just as a kind of tongue-in-cheek critique of this militarization of our environments.
Right.
I mean, if you think about offices have been through the Bürolandschaft, the boss has the corner office, and now they have all these silly doodles in Google offices, you know, to entertain people when you know that they're there to get squeezed out so they can make as much profit as possible. All of that, it's like we live on these fantasy lands without really living in an interesting fantasy land. It's to me very problematic.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to find a way that we could communicate about architecture again that's in an interesting way. I don't know what that problem, how to solve that problem.
Well, it's actually, you know, the best way would be to make regular movies. And those movies would actually look at the environment in relationship to people's behavior. Now it's always the backdrop. But say right. that behavior and architecture were on the same level. Mm-hmm. And there was a way of showing how the environment is being used by this particular fictional character in making his or her life more interesting.
Right.
Architecture, of course, is like it has media constraints. It's right. not a radio. And the thing is that we still, architects still believe that it does affect us. The fact is that we affect it. We make use of it. It's like a tool that you make use of in order to do things in life. And it's so clumsy because we have constrained architecture to the hardware and not realizing that is now hardware is a minimal part. It's really software.
Right.
So architecture needs to expand and include the orchestration of the space and on helping people to write their own fictions.
You know? Right.
And how that's done, you know, I'm getting to be an old man, so I have squeezed out a lot of my lemon. and it seems to me that it is precisely in the arena where you were occupying in that zone between the hard and the soft where some of this innovation can take place.
Well, there is So a lot of some of the research I do is is also in virtual reality.
Yes, of course.
Okay, yeah. As you can imagine. Yeah. And virtual reality has a huge role to play in architecture.
Absolutely.
One, two, because it's a really good way to illustrate your architectural ideas. But my theory is, why not stop in virtual reality and forget about actually going to reality?
Yeah.
Where that just becomes what you want it to become.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because that's a new real estate space, yeah. Right?
If you think about, goes back to something in one of my pet architects, where a guy who, you know, a long, long time ago, they invented the memory palace.
Mm. Ah, memory palace, yeah.
There was an Italian priest that went to China, and he taught the emperor. And this is about memory.
Mm-hmm.
It is, and you know, you invent these palaces in your mind that has compartments and pieces, and you assign meaning or you assign memories to each of those pieces, so that this door is connected to a whole fiction about coming in and out of say war and peace and so on. This was a device. That was in a kind of pre-computer, because it was the hard drive that you invented in your mind, mm-hmm. that you could enter into and walk through and remember. Names are very hard to remember.
Right.
I never remember names. The fact that I remember, no, your name is pretty good. But I remember ideas.
Right.
So I can attach ideas to this memory palace.
Right, right, right.
And those memory palaces are, in a sense, a fictional environment that you can occupy. So it makes perfect sense.
You could feel yourself moving through it.
Yeah, what you were saying is that I could live in a single room, and I can have all these virtual world that I can occupy that makes my apartment six times as large.
Right, yeah.
So, of course, with artificial intelligence, all of this, you know, I can have an avatar moving around in this that is precisely like me and that I can add to every day with the more emotions I come in contact with.
Right.
In other words, there are ways of doing this that you can augment the physical with a virtual and therefore make it get a much richer life. And you could potentially occupy that virtual world with other people, with other players.
Sure.
So, I mean, that seems to me to be a very, very interesting way, because ultimately, maybe we can build cheaper. We don't need all that stuff, because we can, in fact, have a thickness. You know, the old thickness of the wall is now a virtual reality,
right.
that may make me occupy. And instead of watching all this stupid TV, like most of us do, you can occupy those worlds, and you can write your own fictions. You can be in other worlds and have very interesting life. And presumably, you can invent things in those worlds that you can then take out in the sort of physical world.
Yeah. Well, I think that
we have just begun.
We have just begun, but I think that specifically as people start to realize what that is, which of course scares them. Everyone's scared of it.
Oh, right? Of course. It's good to be scared.
Yeah. But I feel that architects have a role to play.
Of course they do. Look, it's a question of survival.
Right.
Because if they don't play in that world, we will be passed.
Right, because then everyone's just going to get the one bedroom.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you don't need to worry about it. But I would love, because I go and I do virtual reality experiences all the time. I go in, I see them, and it's just the opportunity for, like, I would love to walk into a Tom Main creation of some kind, you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Or a Patrick Schumacher or whoever, like, you know, just they're or John Hayduck. Or Libius Woods, or any of those guys, you know, just to experience things that they've never been built, and they don't need to worry about it. So let's experience them this way.
I think that would be incredibly useful in architectural education.
Yes.
Because now the way that we refer to architecture is so superficial, because we never, most projects that we talk about, we have never seen. The students have never seen.
Right.
But if you could, in fact, occupy them in various ways, then it would be very inspiring, you know, and helpful in terms of design. It seems to me that that's where I also have a lot of patience, which you have to gain with old age, that it's we are in the process, but unless we marry those two worlds demonstratively, you know, we engineering has slowly come back to architecture. It was completely out. I mean, when you were here, there was virtually no engineering.
No, everyone wanted to do things in chaos.
But we were, on the other hand, the first ones that were involved with the virtual reality. I mean, I remember the students doing sort of Laterna Magica stuff, you know, with computed images and acting in front of them and, you know, all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
It was very exciting for a while, but that's gone.
Really?
Yeah.
You feel that's gone?
This is gone. Yes. Too many intellectuals.
Too many intellectuals. Do you think that's what's happened in architecture?
Well, I know.
In architectural schools?
I hate to say that, because, I mean, I consider myself an intellectual, and without my intellect, I would be dead. So I'm just saying that there needs to have me more experimentation.
Mm, right.
More willingness to fail. More willingness to break things, you know. It seems to me that, you know, when I was an engineer, in engineering school, breaking beams was really fun.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I saw yesterday a TV program of the Forbidden City. They're mystified over it. It's been standing since the 1400s.
Oh, the wood, the way that the beams are connected.
Yeah, and it's fantastic, you know. I mean, the columns are literally jumping around like this.
Doing an earthquake.
Yeah, and you know, the weight of the roof, when the columns are jumping that way, the roof is jumping that way, so that it counter, you know, it's spectacular.
Yeah.
And that must have been done through experimentation.
Right.
And we don't.
It's completely counterintuitive.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. Because the heavy thing is that's on top, not on the bottom.
Right.
So it seems to me that the fact that we don't experiment, we places like Michigan, in Ann Arbor, have a big lab where they can do all kinds of interesting things, and some of the projects that are coming out in that school to me are fantastic.
Mm.
You know, some of my old students are operating. They're making things all the time. We don't. SciArc was used to be like that too.
Yeah, I walked through SciArc for the very first time. I was doing gave a sort of a guest lecture there about some stuff, and I don't know. You remember? Like, I was one of the first students that bought a computer at my desk at this place.
And then I wish we had a picture of it. You can maybe invent one.
It's, but I was walking through. SciArc, and everyone had computers. Everyone had a computer, and everyone had a 3D printer, and they're all there. And I was like, wow, times have changed, you know? Because I was the guy who was, you know, using all the computers in the lab during
everybody
my thesis.
Everybody has a computer.
Yeah.
But our lab is still minimal.
Mm.
It seems to me that we tend to throw out the baby with the bathwater. So we're abandoning the making part, and that was part of SciArc's absolute, this is its legacy, you know. It had a huge lab with a guy that ran it that was amazing when morphoses were involved and all of that stuff, you know, and that led then to computing. But the fact that the lab in a sense have been more or less not exactly abandoned, but that everything has been put in now in a 3D basket, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that it goes back to Picasso, who learned to paint like Velázquez before he started to distort things,
right.
You know, that you can't miss, you have to have those skills. I mean, you look at yourself, Chris, you have an enormous amount of technical skills that these kids are very far from. They are playing with programs that have no clue what's under the hood, right?
Right.
Because we have never really attempted to learn how to create algorithms ourselves, you know. And in many ways, that people say, "Well, that's idiotic. We don't teach drawing. Why would we teach that?" Well, I think we need to kind of involve ourselves from the inside, so we know how that, you know, plus and minus world operates, and see what the magic it can be built with. So we know how to operate, so we can start to think in those terms as architects.
Right.
And that, I think, is a bit like driving a car. When it stops, we have no clue of how to fix it.
Right.
And it seems to me that in an architecture school, some of that sort of real grunt work has to take place.
So when you were my thesis advisor, as you may recall, and we had to spend the summer coming up with our thesis idea, and I came in and presented to you what my thesis idea was going to be, and you know, I had it all written out, et cetera. And I was sure this was the right way to go. I was positive because I had my undergraduate degree was in mathematics and art, and so I was like, I'm going to make it very math-oriented and bring all my skills here. And I presented to you my thesis idea, which is centered around the golden mean and everything. And you basically said, that's bullshit. And you made me throw it all away. I went from, I am sure this is the right way to go, and to having nothing. So my friend Bob was telling me, he was one of my classmates. He says, what's wrong? It's like, oh, Lars just basically made me throw my whole thesis away. I thought I was all ready to go, and now I don't know what to do. And he says, why don't you got your computer. Why don't you just do stuff, you know? Don't do the things he says, make two lists. Make a list of things you like to do and make the things you don't like to do. And do as many of the things you like to do as possible and avoid doing as many of the things you don't like to do. And I sat at my computer and I just played and played and played. And, well, let's see what this does. Let's see what this does. And I started experimenting with something called metaballs at the time. And I was creating these very weird shapes that I really didn't have much control over. And then you came by. I was like, "All right, so let's see what you got." And he says, "And you said, okay, yeah, dude, keep going with this. Something will come out of this."
Experimentation.
And experimentation. So that was the thing, right?
But you know, it's sort of like when you encounter a student like you, you know that you have a load of knowledge, so you don't need to go back to that. That is going to be in your vocabulary already.
Right.
So if I can push you over the edge into another world, that's my job.
Yeah.
And I have always, on top of that, that's one theory about education that I have. The other one is what I call the kiss and kick method.
Yep.
You know, it's sort of, there is a student that really well-dressed and the project is terrible. I said to him, look, you look so elegant. I mean, look the way you put this together. But then the project is so bad. How is that possible? So that kind
you
of...
You give a compliment, but you kick him.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So
I remember Michael Bell telling me exactly that. It's like, he says, oh, you got the kiss and kick method from Lars today.
You know, that, and that just had actually stood me in good stead, if that's the right way of putting it. And because ultimately, you have to be pushed out the window and be willing to say, before you hit the ground, so far, so good. because otherwise, it's not fun.
Right.
And one thing that really scares me about architecture school, there is very little fun left.
You think so? Do you think it was more fun 20 years ago?
Maybe the students have fun by themselves, but they certainly not convey it.
Mm.
They take criticism all too serious. Somehow, I feel like I'm much more of an authority than I ever was. And it's not, I'm exactly the same person.
Right.
They have no reason to look at me as an authority.
Mm.
They don't attack me the way they used to do. Maybe it's because I've become an old fart, but you know.
Let's go back, because there's another story. This is very, very vivid to me. I was working, I was doing a presentation. I was in John Kasbarian's studio.
Hmm.
And it was downstairs right here. I can see it from this window. I was sitting on that wall, and I was always the guy who was presenting computer renderings, right?
Right.
There were very few people doing, and I was the one who, like, I'll make some renderings for this project. and it was a full jury room. There, everyone was watching. It was, you know, it's in a big sort of open auditorium or space so that people know. And you basically were putting me down, specifically saying, you're always presenting these renderings. It's like pornography, you know. You're trying to tell us your narrative, but this is like pornography. We don't care about the story. We just want to see the pictures. And you said that, and I got really angry. I don't know if you remember this. I slammed down my notebook and I said, "I'm tired of this. I am at the architecture school. I am here to learn. I pay for the tuition. Don't keep talking about my renderings. Tell me how to design. What do I need to do?" And you looked at me with a little. And you're like, "All right." And then we had this conversation and we kept going. And then people were saying, "Oh," and it's like, "I can't believe you said that to Lars. I mean, he's the dean of the architecture school." And I said, "Well, who else am I going to say it to?" Right? And then when I said, "Oh, Lars is going to be my thesis advisor," it's like, "Oh, Lars? I thought you hated him." It's like, "No."
No, but we live in hierarchy country. And, you know, it's particularly obvious to me in terms of having Chinese students. Mm. It's very difficult to get them to talk back.
Interesting.
And the thing is,
there's a cultural thing, obviously.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
I try to provoke people mm-hmm. to get them to talk back, because that's when it becomes interesting. When you have lectured as much as I have, you don't want to hear your own voice.
Sure.
I am much more interesting in the conversation. But I have to lecture in order to kind of present all the
ideas,
so more or less coherently. Mm-hmm. But it's the conversation afterwards. Mm-hmm. So I now have a class here, for example, and it's like pulling teeth. There are two or three people that talk, but most of them are just like this.
Right.
And people have told me in the past, "Well, you scare people." Well, I hope to scare them so they talk back.
Right.
I realized it's not so easy to do, because there is so much coding built in on people that when they encounter a different person, a different way of doing things, they go like this rather than acting up, so to say. Mm-hmm. It's so difficult to say, "Look, you can let your hair down here. This is a safe place,
right?
And here's where the conversation can start." I had this dream when I come as a dean that we would have an endless seminar between me and the student and the faculty. It never really worked.
Mm-hmm. Nearly?
No. Because, I mean, people, the test was this. I was in my office as a dean. More of my faculty would come in and talk to me and so on. When I was no longer the dean, they may say hello to me.
Really?
Yeah. That's what happens. Because they didn't talk to me. They talked to the damn dean.
Right, they were talking to the dean, right.
Like a colleague of mine, also had been a dean in engineering, he said, "You know, the dean had so many friends, I had so few."
Right.
And that, to me, is a societal problem.
Right.
Because you are misread all the time. It's the label that decides what you are, not who you really are.
Right.
And it's taken me a long time to work myself back into the faculty, and I did it very, very demonstratively. Mm. Always with the young people who had never been in contact with me before. Right. So most of my friends on the faculty are young kids,
right.
young assistant professors. Mm-hmm. In fact, I co-write with one of them now, which I've never done before, which is really
great.
Fun.
Yeah.
He's a very bright guy, and we have a great time together.
Right.
And because I realized that now I am in his eyes or in their eyes, I'm just another colleague. I happen to be older, and so there might be some usefulness in that. But otherwise, it's extremely alienating. And for somebody who's like me, is very social when it comes to intellectual things, not so social in other things. I would like to have an endless conversation about interesting things. You know?
Yeah. This is what I do, Lars. I'm podcasting. I'm having conversations with people all day long. I mean, this has been something that I didn't... It was a skill I didn't know I had, by the way. I didn't know that I could have interesting conversations with people, but I knew that... there's something really interesting about that comes out of conversation, of course, more than self thought.
Absolutely. Because, you know, I mean, I guess it's the danger is that it becomes Twitter.
Right.
Yeah, because there are things that slip out in conversations that you say afterwards. I have a couple of those in my life that still haunts me.
Yeah.
That I would like to erase, but can't. Hopefully people involved in those things are dead by now. But, yeah, it's not fun. It's interesting. I have done these kinds of things occasionally, but not so often. I've done most of them in Europe because I realized that my fame is really mostly in Europe.
Okay.
And, you know, I have a permanent employment at Humboldt in Berlin, which has been extremely useful. I'm going to Berlin next week to talk about a project that Ingenhofen has done in Singapore.
Right.
But I was in Holland last year, and one of these kind of odd magazines came and did an interview with me. And I was reading it the other day, and I said, well, this is really, truly me in a way. And me doesn't come out that way in my writing. It's too deliberate. It's too, you know, I rewrite it 10 times. In that conversation, it leaks out some aspiration that I have that otherwise doesn't come out.
Right.
So, you know, the conversation.
But
is,
I think, don't you?
The talking cure.
It is the talking, right? So, and that's. I've always valued my architecture education. I haven't necessarily used it for architecture, but I've always valued my architecture education for some very specific skills that I don't think people realize you get. One is exactly what just happened in that jury room, right? What would happen in that jury room is you can take criticism.
Right.
You know how to take criticism. Exactly. You know how to have a conversation about your design.
Exactly.
And you have to present your work to people every day.
Yeah. So, and you're presenting dreams.
Right.
That's what's very interesting. You don't present things that are already done.
Right.
You're presenting promises.
Right.
And I mean, that's no wonder it's we refer to it as a dream work. You know, that's what's so exciting about it. You have to convince people. In other words, you have to be rhetorically skilled.
Right.
Because you are actually depicting a world that's going to happen. That's not yet there.
Right.
So that is also, you know, that takes chutzpah.
Yeah, that's the skill I learned. I learned that really well, and it's interesting because of, you know, jury reviews, etc. When I worked in the movie industry, you'd go in a screening room, right? And you go in a screening room, the visual effects supervisor, you present your work, what you've done that day. It all goes into dailies. They call it dailies, right? You're looking at, and your work could get torn apart. It's like, oh, this is wrong. You got to fix this. You got to fix that. And you constantly get these critiques. And some people have a real hard time taking that critique. But because I went to architecture school.
Thick skin.
I got thick skin. Not only do I have thick skin is I actually can, I understand that a person's upset, but I also hear what they say.
Exactly.
Right?
Well, I mean, once you realize that a critique is actually something immensely useful. I've heard the descriptions of Gary. Gary hears critique, you know, and he doesn't say very much. And then he goes home and redesigns and come back and shows it.
Right.
And then the guy says, well, that's not what I said. Oh yeah, that's what you said. So, you know, he gets away with murder that way.
Right.
Because when you operate in another medium than in language, because then you have to translate from language to that other medium, and that's a huge leap, particularly since architecture is not a radio.
Right.
So, you know.
Architecture is not a radio.
Somebody said that years ago, and it's very wise. An English architect, name forgot, of course. But he wrote about garbage. Housing versus architecture versus housing or something like that.
Right.
An English guy, very interesting guy, many years ago. Anyhow, the conversation is incredibly important, and it seems to me that conversations are tainted in an American environment because people confuse life with art. They take it personal.
Right.
So if you are criticizing someone, they take it personal. Mm. Instead of realizing that. That's what that kick and kiss method is so important, that the project is independent. Once you have left it, it's out there ready to be taken apart.
Right.
Yes, it's connected to you. Yes, of course it is. But you can pull it back and rework it and then let it out again. Because once you have done something, finally, it's out of your hands. It has its own life. So you have to not confuse life and art. It's very problematic.
Right.
And if you disagree with someone often in the American situations, they dislike you for the rest of your life.
Mm.
Europe is very different. In Italy, for example, where I spend a lot of time, people would scream at each other in reviews, and they would go out and have lunch together, yeah, and all be old friends.
Sure.
It was much more theatrical. It has to be theatrical in, right, a way that you realize that that is a particular stage in the education of a student. It's when you put on your clothes and you make a presentation. I have frequently been told by students, but when we talked, that's not what you said. You said something quite different. Because I had my colleagues there, mm-hmm, the whole thing differently. Things happen. That particular situation promotes a particular insight that you otherwise don't have. That's right. Why we have them. And that's why everybody's envious of the studio. I mean, think about, you study sociology, how boring that is.
Yeah.
You know, all you have to write papers, 100 a day. But you never have these conversations, you know. Well, I mean, obviously you do, but it's very different. That's why the studio is incredibly important. It's our claim to fame, you know.
The studio,
laboratories are the same way.
But isn't the studio a laboratory? Or you?
Yeah.
It is. But I don't think people, you're claiming that you don't think people take it as much as a laboratory as they used to in some ways.
Well, you know, look. Obviously, when you're more of a observer than I am now, since I only teach a seminar, one seminar every semester, mm-hmm, I look at things more than I used to. I was always involved. And it seems to me that the imaginary has been curtailed in some dramatic way. I can't exactly put my finger on it, because there are lots of interesting projects and so on, but it seems like it's still more formal than it is fictional, say, or inventive or creative or about people and their lives and architecture. It's like architecture has been separated into its own autonomous world. Not that I disbelieve that our architecture is autonomous. It's just that life has to be brought to architecture in order to make it interesting.
Right.
And maybe, you know, the students don't talk enough. Faculty talk too much. Mm. And that's something, when you are verbal like I am, that's not always right. I wish I had listened more.
Right.
You know, when you look back at it.
Do you think that there's a generation, because, you know, I had a conversation with this interesting guy named Mahmoud, who's an architect. He was originally from Syria, young guy, very young, by the way. And he does his own architecture visualization firm that he's now formed in Berlin, and he's working in Berlin. But he was basically saying, he's like, where are all the young architects? The young superstar architects, right? All of them, they're all the great architects right now are kind of getting old. And I'm not seeing the young guys that are coming out at like, that are, you know, there's Jörg Engels, you know, he's fairly young, but there's not that zeal, I guess. Do you think, because when it's 20 years ago, so I would have been considered Generation X coming out of this school, right? And now we have the millennials generation. Do you think that the millennial generation, I can't imagine them taking criticism as well as we did back in 20 years ago. I'm not necessarily saying the millennials are at fault, but it may be hard for them to, they need specific answers, I guess. They can't think in certain ways.
Well, you know, I think there is probably a lot around that that's very difficult to put your handle on, but it also has a lot to do with the economy. Architecture is expensive.
It's expensive, yeah.
So, and in order for, and the clients are becoming increasingly large, right, corporate, and therefore it's difficult to invest in some young person that does not have the mileage and can't show 15 projects. So it's very difficult to actually work yourself into a status where you're considered somebody that, that you can take risks with.
Right.
Somebody like Bjarke Ingels operated in a small country with a long tradition of high quality architecture.
Yes.
And probably, you know, he taught here. It wasn't a very good experience we had with him and his partner. But he obviously is very clever and very convincing. So since we don't train architects to convince people about the quality of their work, we tell them to shut up because I'm the critic, maybe there's a problem there. Obviously there are many, the architecture schools, we're producing more architects than ever. And they go often to big offices and they don't have a mother or a father that's willing to have them design their house. It's probably very difficult to put the blame on anything, but it has a lot to do with that, the economic situation. Well, capitalism has gotten much, much more coded and organized and demanding of safe answers. Mm. There is very little risk taking. You know, a building is only as good as the client.
Right.
And if you have clients that are willing to take risks, that have deep pockets, or, you know, example, my friend Carlos Jimenez, he can build a building in Houston for $120,000 a foot. Mm-hmm. Nowhere else can you do that. No. Why can he do it? Because he speaks Spanish. He can connect with people and push down the prices and still get good quality.
Right.
That kind of skill you only get through experience, and it's only people like, you know, people like Carlos who doggedly have been willing to live through, you know, really hard times in order to. I think it's becoming harder to be an architect than ever.
Really.
Because of the economic conditions and the lack of flexibility within the capitalist system.
Mm. Well, that's a shame. Yeah. It's a shame. But here's the other thing I keep telling people is like, don't regret. There's a lot of people I know is like, well, I used to be an architect and now I'm doing this. I said, well, never don't regret your architecture education.
No.
Because your architecture education is what allowed you to do these things. Like the things I do in my life, like I just said, are highly tied to the successes that I've had in the architecture education.
Well, I've said for years that, look, if you have a chance between being a chemist and an architect, a humanist, you know, an English major, it's safer to become an architect. Chemist, maybe not, but it is, because you learn some skills that you otherwise don't have.
Right.
Yeah. And that means that you can, you know, put your shoes on probably, which is an advantage.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. I think.
So that's why it's easier to live with the notion that once you have graduated from architecture school, you're going to have to go through another apprenticeship program and deal with AIA. Dumbest organization ever was. well, in Europe, you when you graduate from an accredited school, you become an architect, and you have learned something. You can actually build buildings, like in Etehan, in Switzerland. You really learn how to build buildings, or in Spain, for example, that in the Madrid School of Architecture, you really learn how to build buildings.
Yep.
And that's something that we have not done very well because of this separation. So we say to ourselves, well, we don't need to do that because you're going to learn that when you go out in the world. We can't invent that in the school. I think that's, and I've argued that, I don't think that's completely correct. I think we need to kind of reinvent the facsimile of the world inside the school, and we do need to make things, you know. And the fact that I worked as a construction worker for several summers in engineering school has been very useful for me. Mm-hmm. I still feel that my engineering education is really the best thing I ever had.
Interesting.
Harder than going to Harvard and to Berkeley. Much harder. Because that was math, that was factual.
Yeah. I get it. I mean, architecture school was pretty hard too, but that was mostly late hours.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, I never worked after midnight.
Oh, really?
Mm. People used to, I mean, my fellow students disliked me because I would come in at 11 and say, okay, how are you doing? I'm finished.
You know what I did? This is actually when I was here, and I noticed that everyone was working until 2 o'clock in the morning or whatever, but they were being unbelievably unproductive during a lot of that time.
Of course. So that's why I never did it.
Right. So I basically, when I was in thesis, I decided pretty much I'm only concentrating on thesis anyway. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go to bed at 6 p.m., wake up at midnight, mm-hmm. show up at architecture school at 1 o'clock in the morning. Everyone is just about to fall asleep or go, and they all leave. And then I've got the whole night to myself. I did amazing productive work at that time. So yeah, I remember that.
I'm best at 6:30 when I get up.
Yeah.
That's when I write for 4 hours and then I go swim and do whatever.
That sounds great. Speaking of writing, I want to make sure that people have a chance to hear you talk about The Continuous City. So when I was talking, this just came out, you said?
Yes, came out. Yeah, The Continuous City. Well, it's very closely connected to Anthropocene.
Right.
It's sort of a equal sign between The Continuous City and Anthropocene. The fact that you can be on the top of the Sierras and you take a sip out of a pond, which you used to be able to do without any problems, and you get sick because there's been some pollution from the city. So, in other words, the effect of the city is everywhere. And that the climate appears to now be a design project.
Right.
Because if we increase the temperature in the ocean, that is prone to make stronger hurricanes.
Right.
And we do that through our pollution. In other words, the city is everywhere. We no longer have an outside. We can't no longer talk about artifice and nature. They're the same. Mm-hmm. It is a force field. So, for example, if you talk about wood is closer to the natural end in this force field than concrete is. But obviously, it now appears that we can push concrete closer to the natural end. And the closer we put materials to the natural end, the more likely is that they will pollute less. Mm-hmm. So all of these binaries that we have operated on, because it's now all in the interior, has to be erased. Mind-body doesn't work anymore, as we know.
Right.
You know, all this sort of, and of course, the identity politics ends up in this place too, because that becomes problematic because we are all now under the same roof. We are now, the rich and the poor is probably still a binary that is very problematic. So in other words, we are now operating in a completely different world, and that is in a planetary world, where the city and its effect is everywhere. Mm-hmm. And that means that we as architects have to look at it differently. And also that we have a spectrum from what I call the stone city, which is mostly made out of man-made materials, to the garden city. And the garden city was never fulfilled. Suburbia happened here. The fact that we cut the lawns and blow all the leaves away, it shows that we are not in the garden city. The garden city in Texas, for example, here in a certain part of Houston, the moist prairie ought to be in the backyard, in the front yard.
Right.
Or the piney woods. In other words, we have to completely change our way of looking at things. when you live in New Mexico, it is different from living in Alaska.
Yes.
And that regional quality, that earthly regional quality, ought to be reflected in the way that there are houses in Houston that would be more intelligent than the one with the pitched roof where all the water spreads into the hard-made surface. In other words, how about flat roofs? You know.
But don't you think, like, all right, I've
heard in other words, there is something about this that is sort of in waiting. That, and it's not the kind of sentimental Heimat stuff, but it's much more consequential because it's understood its place on this earth. Mm-hmm. So all of the stuff that has been touched can now be reinvented. You know, regionalism can take on a completely different quality.
Right.
When the earth is taken into account. In other words, it has to be glocal, always local and global.
Glocal.
Glocal.
I like this.
Yeah.
All right. I like that terminology.
It's very important that you can no longer talk about, cosmopolitanism. I'm a cosmopolitan. Well, it doesn't work very well because that means I'm not attached to anything, which I really am not.
Right.
But I would love to be local and global. And that's not for immigrants
right.
so easy.
I remember, I mean, when 20 years ago, we were talking a lot about the NIMBYs, right? And not in my backyard, right? Yeah. And so
the only planners we have left.
Yeah, and that was a revelation. But if you, I guess you're right, if you do an overall sort of thing that affects the whole thing as well as the micro person in that environment, that has a huge effect. And you're right, the planet is, I really hate the idea of any kind of regionalism, right? When people say, well, I'm an American, I'm a French person or whatever. It's like, I'm a citizen of the planet. That's my first role. And I'm not saying that necessarily in the green hugging thing. I'm just saying this is a planet filled with people of many cultures, and we need to consider that first before we start saying, I am this.
You see, I would say I agree with that, but the fact is that I am here. And that's the only place I can be. In other words, there is always a locality.
Right.
So in other words, I have to think about two things at the same time.
Yes.
We cannot separate them. We can't just say, we are, you know, I'm for the globe and screw you wherever you are.
Right.
You know, that doesn't work. Because we have to now be intelligent enough to think two at the same time.
Right.
Both local and global.
Right.
And that, of course, is tough. Because the moment you decide to do wood windows instead of aluminum window, it has a global effect.
Right.
Because the wood windows are going to come from Canada, the aluminum windows are going to come from Canada, and one uses this much material. In other words, they get so complicated. Mm-hmm. That's what I go back to the first thing, that we have to learn how to put the most productive constraints around our own problems in order, and it's very difficult. Yeah. It's more difficult than ever, and therefore more interesting.
Yeah.
And that's the future we're facing, and that is, it's mind-boggling.
Right. Yeah. Well, Lars, this has been great. I'm going to do all of the people who've been on, I've done Polaroids with. Uh-huh. And so we'll do a Polaroid together. I'll go down to see Jenny, and then maybe she can take a Polaroid of the two of us.
Good.
And we can have it signed. That would be great.
Yeah.
It's hard to find Polaroids now.
I know. I have one at home. I love Polaroids.
But thanks so much for doing this. It's been so much fun and really sort of a...
Well, it's fun for me too.
I was,
you know, it's the most rewarding for a teacher is to see students in their own worlds, and you realize how little you had to do with it. Well, you know, because ultimately it is the power that was invested in you by whoever that and if I have nudge you here and there, and nudging I think is the right word, that is that's very rewarding. But it's really fun also to see, you know, where people end up. And obviously, if I think about your first thesis attempt, it's not surprising that you're sitting right there and with all that experience of yours.
It was
because we are what we eat.
Yeah, exactly. And you did push me, and you did, you know, and you and I did disagree on a lot of things and agree on a lot of things, and we fought, and I learned, and I also felt like I was teaching you some new stuff that I was doing. and then after all of that, even after I graduated, you and I still worked together because we were doing some experimentation and animation with your furniture, and absolutely. I was just making things, and I've always valued it. So when I was coming here to do this talk, and I was going to be at, you know, around at, and I said, it's 20 years since, it's like this timing, I really hope this works out. And it was very, very important for me to see you. So
well,
I was excited.
It was important for me too, because it connects back to what I consider the good times.
Well, great. Well, thanks so much, Lars. I appreciate it.
Yes, thank you.